He's asking for, what he's mainly asking for is if he doesn't use it this year, that he doesn't lose it and go through the process that he has a 2-year based on the circumstances.
Right. What he's saying is he has come before you under oath and indicated he's going to remove all of everything within 13 days.
Exactly.
And will have to undergo the peer review process, as you indicated, that is simply a process. It's no approval or not. What you have to approve is an exemption to the existing law that requires him to set net on that new location so that he does not lose the priority interest, and I would suggest that you do so.
All right. It's a motion to that effect.
I so move.
Motion made by Mr. Holland, seconded by Mr. Garrison. Further discussion to the motion.
We did this in the storm, did we not?
We have done this before.
We have done it before. When the people got the net knocked out and couldn't get it back, we've extended in the storm.
I would just like to say that if it was not for Mr. George making this offer, that I would give him his stand back.
Amen.
And I would
too.
I would too.
Okay. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
Thank you, sir.
Any abstention? Carries. Mr. George? Okay, that's
13 poles up need 60 days.
That's
my error then.
All right.
Mr. Commissioner, I hope we're not setting precedent for this action.
Somebody who's had precedence being put.
All right. You've got two artificial reef requests, Jim. Jack, who's handling that? Mike.
That's why I have the permit confirmed.
Item 20 in your book.
Good afternoon, Mr. Pruitt, Commissioners. Requesting permission to construct two artificial fishing reefs, Coasin Reef, to be located near the mouth of the Coasin River, and Mobjack Bay, to be located on the western side of the channel, just past the entrance to Mobjack Bay. The agency artificial reef program has been advised by the Army Corps of Engineers that applications for two new artificial fishing reefs are in the process of being approved. We should have the Corps of Engineers permit shortly. Local recreational fishing interests support both sites, which follow the artificial reef program's siting plan. Habitat management, law enforcement, and fisheries management divisions have been consulted to see that no interference with existing fisheries should be encountered. The Corps of Engineers, as part of the approval process, advertised the intended development of both reef sites, which are depicted in the material that accompanied this evaluation. This is the first instance in which the reef program has requested approval of the board for the establishment of an artificial reef. This change in procedure will apparently be permanent due to recent changes in the permit application process itself. And I'd like to read the specifics of the two sites we're requesting. The Coasin River, the reef is to be located near the mouth of the Coasin River, northwest of the Coasin Flats, in 21 to 24 feet of water, northwest of buoy number 4. The requested site is rectangular in configuration with the long axis running northeast to southwest. The proposed reef site, measuring 2,000 yards by 800 yards, is to be located off the western side of and run parallel with the channel. The second reef site, if I need to, I'll be glad to read the line positions. If not, I'll go on to the second site. Okay, the second site we're requesting is Mobjack Bay, which is to be located in the mouth of Mobjack Bay in 22 to 25 feet of water. The requested site is also rectangular in configuration, the long axis running northwest to the southeast. The proposed reef, measuring 2,500 yards by 500 yards, is to be located off the western side of and run parallel with the channel, roughly on a line running between Bayside and Guinea Marshes. These permits will allow for the deployment of environmentally acceptable demolition materials, including but not limited to metal, concrete, and other second-use metal and concrete materials, such as pipe, piling, manhole structures, etc. Coast Guard-inspected and approved vessels and specifically designed artificial reef structures, such as tetrahedrons and domes. Initial development of these two new reefs is planned to commence by or before this summer. And both of the proposed sites are depicted on the attached information. Staff recommendation is for approval to proceed with the initial construction of these two new reef sites.
Any questions from the commission? Is this a change in the process?
Yes, it is.
This is the new process for approving artificial reefs that gets us out of, I guess, the habitat permit process here at the agency. It does still requires approval of the commission, and we still have to go through the federal permitting processes, which involve a public comment period as well.
All right. Anyone in the audience, pro or con, on these reef sites? All right. This is it right now, isn't it? This is it right now.
There's no requirement.
There's no requirement for a public hearing, but it's my always been my policy to hear from the public whether or not.
Kelly Place, Coastal Virginia Watermen Association. I'm somewhat concerned over the piecemeal taking of all the various fishing spots that have been shared spots between recreational and commercial over the years. And I'm not up here opposing the two sites for the reef, but I do think there should be a rather lengthy review process before one user group is given essentially a de facto title to the subaqueous bottom where these reefs would be over other user groups that have had use of these areas essentially since the beginning of time. I don't want that construed again to be opposition to these reefs, but some friends in the recreational community have told me that part and parcel of their strategy, if they can't end certain commercial fisheries, that they'll do it piecemeal by taking parts of the bottom and parts of the shoreline and the bridges and the piers and the abutments. So I do have a concern that this reef, like other artificial reefs, will be another large area and all its periphery that will be closed to all but one user group. So I do have those concerns, and I would like to see further discussion, make sure all user groups are fully apprised of what the ramifications would be over time. Thank you.
Anyone else? All right, Mike.
Charles Dryden. I'm a waterman from Pocosin, and we've heard nothing about this reef and where it's going to be placed or anything like that. I just got agenda the other week and seen it on there and come to see what's going on. And I'd like for y'all in future ones, I reckon, to go and like try to put some information out so people know where these are going to be placed and stuff like that. What he's telling me, northwest of number four, everybody from Gloucester to Pocosin set gill nets all down in there in the springtime and the fall time, like for spot fishing and croaker when they come in. That's basically all I have to say, but like I said, nobody down there, I can tell you right now, but me, the only one that really knows that this is taking place today. Thank you.
I appreciate what you all had to say on that, and I was consulting with the attorney here on exactly what the law requires first, and work from that. Mike, did you have anything to say after what you've heard?
Are consistent with past practices in that our average size of a reef acreage-wise in a bay is about 308 acres. Mm-hmm. The Mob Jack Reef is 258, Pocosin is 331, so we're in line with what we've done in the past, and it's another one of these situations where we attempted to site the reefs where we thought we were out of everybody else's way and still had enough water depth to actually mm-hmm. construct a reef.
When do you expect the Corps permit?
It was supposed to have already been here. I would expect it very shortly.
Where are you as far as material and all that? And when would you want to start construction?
we could easily be underway by this summer with it. We have RFPs that we're working on right now for concrete materials to put overboard, and we are going to use those to start these two new sites.
I'm inclined to let this go over a month and let the folks in the Pocosin area. This is a little different than when you get into these tributaries. It's a little bit different than out in the bay.
If it,
I think we ought to give folks a little more time to comment.
I'd be more than happy to see if I could arrange some meetings with the folks.
Why don't we do that and bring it back next month and we'll vote on it then.
Sure.
We won't have any more advertisement, but we know where the issue is. It's in the Pocosin area. Maybe some of in Gloucester. Just get those two communities notified.
All right, we'll do.
What did you say their acreage coverage was?
The Mob Jack Reef is 258. Pocosin is 331.
Acres?
Yes, sir. And our average for a bay reef is about 308.
Acres. What's your average depth of the actual reef itself, 8, 10 feet deep?
They're about, these are 21 to 24 feet and 22 to 25 feet. The Corps of Engineers will require 12 to 15 foot clearance.
Yeah, I know that, but they're pretty high reefs in pretty deep water.
So we'll have maybe 8 to 10 feet of clearance depending on what's on that final permit.
I mean, how high is the reef itself? The
8 to 10 foot.
8 to 10 feet?
That's what we're permitted. We usually run 4 to 6 feet when we're using demolition material, like bridge pile, decking, things of that nature.
All right. Thank you.
Sir.
Dr. Kirkley.
Afternoon, Commissioner Pruitt, members of the Commission. I'm Jim Kirkley from the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, and I'm here, I guess, to give an introductory overview on the economic status of the commercial and recreational fisheries of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Yeah, if we can get everything here working, and I can see. All right. In the name of brevity, since obviously you guys can go on longer than I can, I'm going to skip some parts of this, particularly the mathematical modeling part and the introduction of it. That's, to some of us, that's the most fun part, but in any event, what we're going to do is we're going to just kind of briefly touch on what's called input-output modeling. That's the basic methodology we use to estimate and assess the economic ramifications of the commercial and recreational fisheries. Provide a brief summary overview of the commercial sector, discuss some economic contributions of the commercial sector, do the same for the rec sector as well. Without going through all the IL and all the modeling stuff, input-output modeling is simply a mathematical quantitative approach that allows you to track expenditures and sales and economic activity through an economy. You have three levels of impacts that are generated. It's called a direct impact. For example, a recreational angler goes to Walmart and buys rods and reels and some other tackle. That's a direct impact. But Walmart, at the same time, they have to buy those rods and reels from some other place. That becomes an indirect impact. Then, to top all that off, wages are paid throughout the whole system. The employee who sells the goods and services at Walmart, the recreational angler who realizes income, all of which generates income, and the income is spent on other goods and services, and it just flows through ever out the economy. At some point, the flow becomes so infinitesimally small, it shuts down. That represents the three combinations or the three levels of impacts that we assess with input-output modeling. This is completely different than what we call net benefits or economic value. It was made clear very early on when we first came back to do this second time study that no one wanted to hear anything about economic benefits or net benefits or economic value to society of goods and services. All right, for our sake, we'll skip through there really quick. Skip on the mathematics again and the multipliers. All right, the impetus of the study, what actually happened is that the recreational community, along with certain individuals of Virginia Marine Resources Commission, asked could we update an earlier study from 1994. And, of course, since some of us like me are really greedy and willing to take money for funding, more, sure. Be glad to do it. All right, the objectives of the study, really simple. Estimate and assess the economic importance of the commercial and recreational fisheries. This time, however, do something a little different. Basically, I'm a very, very lazy person, and I don't like to do analysis over and over and over. So we decided to develop these models and then be able to teach VMRC staff how to do their own economic impact assessments. It's a very easy thing to do, and it saves me a lot of trouble this way if Mr. Travelstead or somebody at VMRC says, well, we're looking at this new regulation. We're thinking about allowing an increase in a quota or a decrease in quota. What's going to be the impacts? Now we can say, well, here, you do it. So I don't have to do it anymore. The other thing we want to do is, we haven't done this part yet, but make these models available online.
Give her money back, Jim, when you do that.
Pardon me?
You give her money back?
Heck no. I already gave you back like $12,000 I ate on indirect overhead for having to put $65,000 back to do an add-on to the MRF survey.
Mm. Okay.
Anyway, this last one, we have some ideas, and we're going to talk with...
Jim, this is with the same multipliers through the commercial industry, too. It's not ex-vessel value.
This is, this particular set of models goes from harvesting sector, processing, wholesaling, restaurants, retail.
So we're apples and apples.
We are, we're apples and apples. I really wish we weren't apples and apples because I want to get out of here before somebody whoops me later today. But.
So we're McIntosh and Braeburns.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's the point of the whole thing. And there's some legitimate concerns about that comparison. But if you don't do that comparison, then one sector is always going to fall out. I mean, that's the bottom line on it. All right. The third thing was, like I said, to make these models available online, but to do some public relations things, I hope, which would allow, say, a commercial waterman and or a recreational angler to go online and say, well, we took a trip today, and we took a charter trip, and we spent $1,400 and blah, blah, blah. You know, what? Geez, look at what we generated for the economy. And the same thing could be done by watermen as well. You know, well, we landed, you know, we got, I don't know what a scallop trip is now, but let's say it's $150,000, you know, for a trip. And they could say, well, geez, look what we generated in impacts. Scallops are doing very well. Okay. The model basics, M-Plan is an off-the-shelf mathematical software package you buy. It costs $2,500 for the state of Virginia and all counties. One thing I left out from the previous introduction is that, different from last time, this time we built the models for all the counties and municipalities as well to facilitate community planners and developers at the various county levels. When you develop these models, you have to build all these custom sectors to, just like Dr. Jones says, to track through processing, wholesaling, and all the different components. How did we get all this information? Well, we did a survey. All right, we did a survey, mail intercept telephone survey of recreational anglers. With the commercial sector, we did mail and personal interviews. I now also had some wonderful responses from the industry where I think I know where I can go live now. One thing we were able to do is piggyback processors of a survey of processors. We were already conducting a NOAA-funded survey on processors. The processing sector is often left out of the environmental impact statements on federal FMPs, and so there's concerns about how do we bring it in. So pulled our money and did a little double dipping. All right, some backgrounds. Whoa, that is tough to see. I'm sorry. some backgrounds on the commercial sector. These are listed top 10 species. The set to the left is 1950 to 1959. This actually looked better on my other system, so I don't know. But if you look down, there's a column, has the name of the species, then it gives you millions of dollars of landed value, and then it gives you cumulative percent of total landed value of all species. So the way to read that far left column is that on average, 1950 to 1959, eastern oysters were worth about $54.6 million a year. These data or a combination of VMRC data and NOAA data. Menhaden had a landed value during that period on average of about $15.7 million a year. These values, these dollar values, are ex-vessel values, dockside values, first sale values. They are measured in terms of 2005 constant dollars. That means we've taken the values from 1950 to 59 and adjusted them for inflation forward. And if you look down, what is kind of interesting, from the 50 to 59 period, you have a really nice distribution of species in terms of eastern oyster, 47%, menhaden adds on some additional 11, 10, 12%, 61, but you're down, you don't get to, you get to all 10 species till you hit about 90% of your total landed value. So you had a broader distribution. That middle set looks at the entire period, 1950 to 2004, same thing, top 10 species, menhaden being the top, eastern oyster being the second, sea scallops being third, et cetera. What is becomes a bit disconcerting is that third column, or third set of numbers, and again, I apologize. It looks really good on the screen, by the way. But in any event, that third set of numbers is the annual values for 2000 through 2004. If you look at it, sea scallops is at $64.6 million. That's the average landed value of sea scallops from 2000 to 2004. It's the top ranked. It contributes 46% to the total ex-vessel revenue. What is disconcerting about this is when you come down to summer flounder, you're into four species. You've identified three identifiable fisheries in terms of the scallop, which is primarily dredge, menhaden, purslane, blue crab, primarily pot and dredge. Summer flounder, oddly enough, a lot of that is caught in the dredge. Scallop dredge. It's a bycatch. What is disconcerting is you're hitting 85% of your total landed value between 2000 and 2004 with only four species. To me, that should be of considerable concern. Now, let's take a look at some general trends in landings. Unfortunately, it just doesn't show that well, but the blue represents total landings all species. The green is total landings. These are landings, pounds of landings, after you remove sea scallops from the landing series. The little brown one down here is total landings after you remove sea scallops and menhaden. Things aren't really looking that well. You're seeing a significant decline, and this is in landings. This is not unusual relative to what is going on for the entire United States. Out of 23 states reporting marine-based species, 16 of them are showing significant declines in landings, particularly landed value. The blue line here represents the ex-vessel value, first sale value, dockside value, in terms of 2005 constant dollar value for all species, including scallops. Looks like it's increased, and it shows a significant spike up. Take a look at the green line, though. The green line removes scallops. Now the value is dramatically decreasing. Remove sea scallops and menhaden, and the decrease is even more exaggerated. That should also be of some concern. If we look at the big picture of Virginia relative to the United States, we can see that the top line, of course, is an index of ex-vessel value for the United States of America. And that's covering the entire period 1950 through 2004. The lower line is that of Virginia. The United States is in a state of decline. Virginia is actually kind of stabilizing and flatlining and is showing some gains in the most recent periods. But again, those gains are related to sea scallops. That's really where those gains are coming from. Because, like I said, if you take sea scallops out, you show a decline.
Jim, can I ask a question? Is that decline in the ex-vessel values because there's a decline in poundage or decline in cost per pound?
There's a whole combination of factors that's going on. I've got some stuff later, but here's what's happening. You've got tremendously increasing fuel prices, which is just literally killing the industry to pieces. You've got increasingly restrictive regulations nationally. I mean, they're getting tougher and tougher. You've got essential fish habitat Marine Mammal Protection, Endangered Species Act, is sent, you know, so forth and so on, all of which is affecting what these people can take. The resources themselves are having some issues. In some years, you've had, like, boycotts of swordfish. And then we have the really horrible thing that I'm going to show a little bit what later is international trade. When you start dumping shrimp on the domestic market for $3.99 a pound, you know, and this is foreign-raised shrimp, forget it. You know, $3.99 a pound for something that looks maybe pink, white, brown versus $12.99 a pound for Key West pinks. At that point, I got to choose the $3.99 a pound one, and that's going on nationwide. Right. In terms of our analysis that we did for these economic impacts, we looked at all the species' reported landings in the Commonwealth of Virginia. By now, most of you probably have seen the press where there's some issues about the magnitude of the commercial versus the rec sector. We'll address that. But if we look here at cumulative percent, this far right column over here, cumulative percent of total landed value, we're at 90% at the summer flounder line. That's four down. That says all the other species landed in Virginia, as per what is reported, contribute only about 10% to the total landed value of the Commonwealth. All right. Economic impacts. Now, if I remember, the newspaper reports had $439 million of total sales. We developed this model in response to criticisms, constructive criticisms, and comments from the previous 1994 model that said, well, can you do it only for landed product? Can you do it for what's brought into the state? Can you put a bunch of bells and whistles that allows us to look at it in different ways? So the press reports on this came out looking only at what's landed in Virginia. All right, and only at that time what was reported, this is no offense to VMRC, but only what VMRC had for data in terms of landed value. That did not include what is acquired from out of state. We all know the storyline on blue crabs and oysters, at least in terms of what's coming from out of state. It's huge. And I mean, it's just phenomenal. And somewhere between 70-80% between those two species have been coming in from out of state. It's not going to be coming, obviously, probably from the Gulf of Mexico this year, but nevertheless, it had been coming. All right, the total impact here, I forget what VMRC gave me originally. I think it was like $140 million ex vessel value. We've updated and taken some of the NOAA data, re-examined the economic contributions, et cetera, and we're up at a landed value of $165.3 million. If you look at that middle column, that middle thing called output impacts, which I think appears somewhere else in big and larger size, it's $586.7 million in terms of total sales, or what we call total output. Total sales would be the total sales of goods and services generated over and over in an economy. Then we have this total value added, which represents wages, profits, salaries, actually indirect taxes, et cetera, and that's up to $346.4 million, and our total employment is up to about 5,654 individuals. We're calling it full-time / part-time, but every effort's been made to make it full-time. But there's, unfortunately, some slop in the information, so we call it full and part-time, but these tried to be converted to the equivalent of 12 calendar month jobs. All right. This one we can skip, okay, because I can't even read this one. But these are the same things repeated at the county municipality level. Again, this was done this time to add more information to both to VMRC and to municipalities so that they could better estimate some of the economic ramifications. Again, you get total sales generated, total value added, total employment. From this, you can also calculate total tax revenues to the Commonwealth. Total income tax, even total sales tax paid. All right, economic impacts by species. Again, this includes product from out of state. Those are kind of by the numbers there total. What is staggering that stands out, you can dispute any of the numbers you want. There's no doubt about that. You can dispute just about any number on this stuff or any other type of assessment. But what stands out here is the scallops. You know, it's 3,258 in terms of the employment. That's phenomenal. I mean, that's really phenomenal. What's happening from the previous periods is that the employment is really dramatically declining in these other fisheries, substantially. And just so you know, while we were doing this survey, we discovered through the mail survey that a lot of people hold licenses, but they don't use them. And there's a lot of people who are retired who are never going to give up their license. And they haven't done it for a long time, at least so they say. They also are very, very articulate, again, telling you how you can go here and get there. All right. What I'd like to point out is we're actually, with the new numbers from what we did before, we actually have an increase relative to 1994, but it's one of those increases that is so small, it's kind of like, well, is it real or not? What I'd like to stress is that let's not really jump to wrong conclusions on what's happening with the commercial fisheries in the Commonwealth. If you look at them at a glance, you might say, kind of like going free fall, it's collapsing, because this is really what's going on nationwide. When you start looking down here, for example, the real or inflation-adjusted price over a 55-year period decreased by 1 cent a pound. This is probably one of the only places you see this kind of stuff is in fisheries. Right? Something that's really important to this particular analysis is that everybody who was around here remembers Isabel, or maybe just wanted to blot it out of their minds, you know. But that had to have some effect on commercial fishing. Besides boats being turned upside down and washed up and vessel owners and crew having to spend time repairing their homes and other things, it had to have some effect, but we don't really know what it was. All right. Federal and state regulations have become increasingly restrictive over time, and, of course, there's been major increases in fuel prices. I just calculated the fuel price change this morning because I'm doing this same type of stuff for the United States. Since 1994, number two, diesel has increased 47%. That's a hefty increase, and that hurts. All right, something else here that's behind some of the changes when we find these changes in ex-vessel prices and values. Imports, I'm sorry for the bottom. This is run off a particular software package that doesn't know how to write numbers on the bottom. But the bottom is year goes from 1990 through the end of 2005. And if you look at the blue, that's millions of pounds. And I think you can conclude, whoa, that's skyrocketing on up. And if you look at the exports, so the blue is going to be our imports and the green is our exports. You don't have to be really particularly on top of the math to say, uh-oh, we got a balance of trade issue already right here. It's pretty scary. This is all right here is edible seafood.
Jim, what's primarily coming in?
Shrimp, tilapia, Nile perch. Those are three of the major ones. Cod is another big one.
Farm-raised salmon.
Yes. The majority of what we're seeing coming in is, in fact, farm-raised. This is something I think FDA, somebody else needs to look at. I don't buy farm-raised mahi from Indonesia. I'm having a serious problem with that one. I know there's some stuff going on, but that's really pushing the envelope.
How does crab meat figure into that?
Pardon me?
Crab meat, how does that figure in?
There's a lot of crab meat coming in, and what we've seen now is, I don't know if you've been, probably have, but to Walmart or another retail outlet, and they now have snow crab from France, maybe, Thailand.
Maybe.
Thailand? I have some problems with that one, particularly since the legs are about the size of a pencil. But nevertheless, they're there. They're $2.99, $4.99 a pound, and the domestic consumer says, $7.99, $9.99, $2.99, $3.99. I'll take it. Yeah, exactly what that is. Okay, when we start looking at the value, again, the imported value skyrocketing. This is edible product. I'll know better next time than to do a beige on a blue on a white or something because it's hard to see, but there's a beige line at the bottom. You're looking at roughly $7.5 billion in balance of trade deficit in edible seafood. That's significant. That's a humdinger. Non-edible seafood, you're looking at about $3 to $4 billion. You're looking at a total of nearly $11 billion balance of trade deficit. That's dollars leaving the United States for edible and non-edible seafood products, or aquatic products, rather. That's one reason why ex-vessel prices are declining and ex-vessel revenues are being hit hard for the industry. Virginia, I heard this a minute ago, Virginia's balance of trade, take a look at 2005. Virginia is running a deficit of nearly $200 million of a trade deficit. Let me repeat that, $200 million, just so nobody thinks it's $200 million. Okay. 2004, it was about $225 million. You just can't go on and have a really healthy industry if you're going to push everything out, you know, bring everything in. You just can't. And this hurts. This also doesn't adequately include, this is strictly foreign trade reported into the Commonwealth and exported from the Commonwealth. It doesn't include what we buy from New Jersey that came from, say, Thailand, China, or Indonesia. So this here is a gross underestimate. All right, on to the recreational fisheries.
And Jim, just as an aside, I think from my reading, the fact is that fishermen here are required to keep sustainable fisheries, a clear environmental cleanliness about what they do. And you go into countries like Indonesia, and what you see is a wholesale destruction of their mangrove swamps,
right,
and pollution of their nearshore waters. So that they're not really paying the full, the export is not covering the real cost to the fisheries.
No, that's absolutely true. The exports are not. And if you can, for example, in Vietnam, they're not after their farm raised stuff for the way we do economics and business. They're after foreign currency, and they can get it. That's one way to get it. They need foreign currency. Indonesia's different. They've got pretty good money, so they're into it for the money, but they have big cost savings. I've been dealing with some people with Australia and New Zealand recently dealing with aquaculture, offshore aquaculture, and they're all staffed by Indonesians because it's low-cost labor. We can't do stuff like that. We just can't do it. And our regulatory burden in this country is becoming increasingly complex and increasingly restrictive on our industries, on our commercial fishing industry in particular. And
But again, the lack of restrictions there end up in wholesale destruction of their environment.
Yeah. Eventually they do. And they will. All right, on to our recreational situation. Here, our top line is the number of anglers, saltwater anglers in Virginia, covering the period 1981 through 2004. We then have coastal anglers, non-coastal anglers, and out-of-state anglers. What is not of concern, but it's kind of a nice, pleasant thing, is that the number of saltwater anglers between 94, and I'm using that because that's when we did the previous study, through 2004 increased by 76%. It's almost 500,000 increase from that period. That's a significant increase. I mean, that's just a huge increase. Angler trips have increased in that 10-year period by more than 1.1 million. They've gone from about 2.6 million to about 3.6 million in that period, that same 10-year period. Oddly enough, and I don't really believe this, and for those of you who have worked with MRF's data, you probably don't believe anything out of there, but this says that the number of trips per angler has actually declined in the 10 years. I don't believe that myself from the experience. And the data collection we did to support these analyses show somewhat different. But when we were building these models, one thing we had in mind is that how can we construct a system that would allow VMRC to cost-effectively re-examine the economic contributions of the commercial and rec fisheries? The Commonwealth just doesn't have the money to go out and do their own rec survey year after year. It's just cost-prohibitive. You know, so as a consequence, we said, well, how can we piggyback? Well, we'll piggyback MRFs. And that's it's kind of like one of these things. Well, maybe the data are bad, but they're consistently bad over time. I don't know if that's a good reason, but it's one we try to use as a weasel out.
What was that big change in the early 80s? That when the gas...
I think it's data reporting. Yeah. I think it's... Yeah. You can almost map out changes in contractors as well, because you move from, was it Quantec to Macro, I think their name is, recently. So you get these spikes. Every time you get a new contractor, you get this huge spike because they're all excited, gung-ho, you know, or else they've got a... I don't. This is probably exaggeration, but you may have a bunch of new surveyors who... don't know what they're doing, so they go out and make up surveys. They sit down because they'll get paid by the completed survey.
But these are trips. These are trips, so these come out of the telephone.
Yeah, so these come out of the estimates, yeah.
You can't make these disparaging remarks for somebody who knows the survey.
I sure can.
After just won't get away with it, Jim.
After being crucified on the phone from Noah the other day about Murph's survey, I don't know.
One of our first fuel crashes was 82, so you could have had a reflection on that.
Yeah.
And what's your mean age of the average angler? That's redundant. What's the age of the average angler? Because I've been reading...
We actually have the data.
I've been reading it's been going up.
I know for the watermen it's going up tremendously.
I know, but I think...
I mean, the waterman goes up from about 54 to, in his, I think, about 64, 67 or so for the waterman. We have the data for the wreck angler, but we didn't do anything with it. It's one of those things, since you do survey work and know, you ask more than you're really going to use at that time because you know it's going to be neat to use later. The only thing you get out of these things is eventually your peer review publication.
Well,
so
this also predicts what Virginia can expect to see, because if the mean age of the commercial fishermen is going up, as we know it is, it means that there's going to be an accelerating decline in the fishery.
Right.
But from what I'm reading, there's also an increasing age of the average angler, which also means that Virginia can anticipate some decline in her recreational fisheries.
Yeah. I don't know. Some of us old ones just keep going and going.
That's because you keep trying to catch a fish.
That's right.
Slower and slower.
Who spend $1,500 to catch one striped bass? Okay, number of angler trips by mode. Well, you can see pretty much here. Don't be shocked. In the Commonwealth, it's private and rental boats. It's the dominant mode of recreational angling in the state. Charter and charter boats have kind of, they're flatlining is what they're doing. They're flatlining in terms of number of angler trips. And the shore-based, well, that's a rock and roll kind of show, but it's on a general increase over time. All right, number of trips and expenditures by mode. Pretty much you can stop things from Accomack below in terms of trying to identify and look at Virginia, the state of Virginia, and what you find is that anglers spent about $655 million engaged in saltwater recreational angling in 2004. That's a chunk of change. That's a lot of money. I also want to stress to the VMRC staff particularly that the county municipality models are pretty good for estimating economic impacts by mode, all right? But there's some serious limitations in terms of those counties. You could, for example, Virginia Beach is pretty solid, Norfolk is pretty solid, et cetera, like that, where you have big responses and a big and large recognizable activity. When you get to some of these, you say, ooh, you know, like King George County, I feel a little uncomfortable with the assessment of King George County. It's usable, but it's just very sparse in terms of data. Okay, so when we come across and look at these economic impacts, here we have a total impact in the Commonwealth. Total sales output generated from recreational angling in the Commonwealth of Virginia is $823.7 million. That's large. That's very, very large. Right, in terms of all fishing modes, and I mean in terms of value added or income generated, we're looking at about $478 million. And in terms of full/part-time jobs, with the same caveat being it's really effort to do full, is about 9,100.
How much of that comes from out-of-state anglers?
Well, in this case, it's probably about 30 to 35%, I think. On this particular one, most.
So that's what.
You've been reading this stuff too long. The reason that's an important question is because out-of-state anglers represents new economic activity to the state.
Yes.
Because if I don't go recreational fishing, I'm probably going to home get drunk, or I'm going to go bowling, you know, or hunting, or to the movie theater, or something. So I'm still going to spend the money in state, still generate impacts. So the argument is most often is that you want to look at new economic activity. But
that's
still
about $250 million.
Yeah, but if you do it there, then you got to do the same thing for the commercial sectors and say, well, if this guy, person can't fish, maybe they can work here. Maybe they can do this, to do that. So you try to keep away from that. But that's a very valid thing. In Canada, by the way, it does the way you just said. Yes, sir.
One question out of quickly. Value added figures there where you've got all fishing modes,
yes.
299 million, 84 million, et cetera. Now, if you were to look at one of those columns and try to figure out what does a sector generate in terms of direct revenue per se, would you go there?
Yeah, go to the output impact.
You go to the output?
Yes, that's the total revenue sales generated throughout the whole economy. That's, for example,
okay, but
I still buy my rod, and Walmart buys the rod, and that pays somebody,
right.
You know, they pay for a rod.
From China.
Yes.
Right, right. But if you want to go back to, so when I said direct revenue, you took that to include multipliers, but if you want to avoid the multipliers and just go to the direct expense, would that be the value-added direct value added?
No,
column
that
there?
Would actually
that
be back column? Here where the right side, those four columns say total expenditures. That's everything that's spent.
Okay, and what is
somebody,
that?
What is spent total? Is received by somebody in the state.
Right. And you're saying that's about $655 million for all categories of recreation?
For every single thing.
Okay.
For everything. I will give a cautionary note on this study relative to the 94 study because somebody might be concerned in the 1990. When you do these analyses, not everything you spend obviously stays in state.
Right.
When you buy fuel for your boat, you know that's not staying in state unless you got lucky and got it from giant refineries. You know, and even then, all that oil came from out of state. When you buy that rod in Rio, you're probably looking at 90% of that leaving the country. It's coming from various Asian nations and whatnot and the other. In the earlier study, we did use, for the expenditures, we adjusted them ahead of time for what's called regional purchase coefficients.
Mm-hmm.
In this study, to make life easy for BMRC staff, the purchase coefficients are inside the model. So, in other words, if $100 million was spent last time, and we were looking at something like groceries, we would multiply the $100 million times 0.3 and say, well, Angler spent $30 million on groceries in the Commonwealth. This time, when they spend $100 million, it shows up $100 million, but the model adjusted internally. So it does cause a little bit of confusion for some people, particularly for people who don't waste their time doing this, John. All right, county municipality level, again, there's probably some weaknesses in here. My guess is that this is very reasonable for Accomack, Gloucester, Matthews, Middlesex, Northampton, York, Newport News, Hampton, Norfolk, and Virginia Beach. And Virginia Beach, of course, is the biggie here. That's where a lot of the recreational economic activity is generated. Economic impacts by rec species. This is always contentious for people because on our questionnaire and on our assessment, one of our concerns were no random, no particular desired species or species complex. Because there are a lot of people in this state, and myself included, who just go out. You don't really care half time if you even catch anything. You know, it's just like, well, I want to go, but I've got my grandchild. So it'd be nice if I caught something.
Jim, for those of us who are blind and can't read that type, would you just read the first five down?
Multiple species, rockfish, bluefish, summer flounder, weakfish. Unfortunately, they're not ordered by magnitude. In terms of total impact, multiple species here, of course, came in number one. All right. In the previous study we did in 1994, the large game fish came in number one. They don't this time. I can't tell you why. The second most important one is a species complex, which I believe is spot and croaker. right? And this past year, I mean, in 2004 and 2005, there was a lot of spot and grouper and a lot of anglers and all these public piers being open with free access. So that's not real surprising. Rockfish, it's a real main one. That's not really very startling, particularly if you try to find a spot down towards the Bay Bridge Tunnel in the fall and you're on a boat. So you pretty much can get a breakdown by species. Big picture summary deal kind of thing here. Commercial and recreational fishing together, they're important to the economy, no doubt about it. Together they generate about $1.41 billion in total sales or output. They also generate an important, about impressive 14.7 thousand jobs. For those of you who may be interested, Eastern State Hospital generates about half of this rec and commercial fishery combined in terms of economic impacts. People always want to know the parallel. Well, there's a lot of bigger players out there, and if you read the newspapers, in the past 2 weeks, a study by William and Mary alone has come out showing that our college generates about $400 to $450 million in total sales and about 7,000 jobs. So there's some issues here. But what's important about this is you get it bang after bang after bang. That's the really nice thing about our Commonwealth's natural resources. I'm going to stop it here if there's any questions, because these tables here were just prepared in case somebody has particular issues. Yes, sir.
I think this is a great presentation. I'd like to thank you for making it today. One thing that it highlighted, though, back on the commercial side is just the importance of collecting good landings data, because we obviously have a few gaps there on some of the fisheries. I noticed the conch figures. We've obviously been in discussion on that, and that's I think we've still got some fisheries that are in between fisheries that aren't going directly to federally permitted dealers, and we still have some data gaps to work on.
Yeah,
but it just shows the importance too of the mandatory reporting program, and that, you know, it really, without good data, managers can't make informed decisions. So it's imperative that fishermen participate, that dealers abide as well, and I just think it underscores the importance of having good data to work with.
Jack, that issue, the conch, Jack very diplomatically called me up in a state of panic. He didn't really cuss me out. He said, "We have a problem here." He said, "I'm showing $700 to $800 million, and you're showing like $100 million or $90 million or whatever it was." And I said, "These are your data." So, and it's that way for particularly. And this is unfortunate because the newspaper people got this part wrong, but, you know, that happens to all of us. For species that are subject to an FMP, there is tight data collection activities. For species caught in the EEZ but not subject to an FMP,
not under federal,
e.g. conch, there's no requirements for that. It's not mandatory. It also is the same on processors. And that's something that we didn't really cover in here, but the number of processors have declined in the Commonwealth by, what, 37%. And processor employment's declined by 30%. Remember what's going on here, and this is not unique to Virginia. It's not unique to the Commonwealth. Same thing in Maryland. You're finding New Jersey, up and down the coast, they're not processing the way they used to. It's more or less repackaging it. Mm-hmm. Take it in the front door, wrap it in green or purple or whatever's popular to the consumer, put a, you know, I won't say Virginia's finest, Maryland's finest label on it, and ship it out the door. We're finding more and more of that going on. Who do you think is doing all that shucking and picking me? H-2B workers. Where does their money go? A good portion of it goes back to their native home country. This is a nationwide pattern that's going on, and we're going to continue, unless something's done, we're going to continue to see declines in not just Virginia's fishing industry, but probably America's fishing industry across the board. If you look at something like pollock, it rose like gangbusters starting in 89. I mean, it goes from about $10 million a year to almost $400 million a year. Its price right now, not right now, but in 2004, is only a few pennies more than menhaden. It's 8 cents a pound. So. Yes, sir.
Can we get a copy of this study?
Absolutely. I told you at the beginning I'm lazy. That's why I didn't bring 50 copies with me. because I don't want, like, to carry them. But I, the study is available both online, and we do have hard copies printed.
I'd like to have a hard copy.
Okay, yeah. Sure.
Tim, what would, just for curiosity, what do you think can save the situation?
I think you need to get a small group of industry leaders together who really know what they're doing and sit down and identify the problems that are occurring and strategies to resolve those problems. And you've got to get a lobby in force before the administration to say, look, we need some money. We need to do something. I personally, from what I'm looking at, I don't see us taking advantage of our value-added opportunities.
Nope.
Here and there we see it, but yep. Across the board, I mean, you take a large, you know, big this
what Omega
ship it out the door. That's a nice crack.
Big this is compared to what Omega does.
You know, striped bass, I'm not sure you do a whole lot more striped bass, but my guess could be hurt. Probably something. You know, and I think in the Commonwealth, we've got good, strong, solid demand for sea scallops and most of the in these large offshore fisheries and species. You know, but for our inshore species, we really need to take a hard look at how we're going to enhance the resource. How are we going to get the resource back? The resource goes up, that means your cost of production goes down. It means you put more money as a fisherman in your pocket, right? You work the markets. You become competitive. Mm-hmm. You know, so we just need some really serious homework, and the state needs to fork over some money. Not to them, but to people who know what they're doing.
Do you think that the commercial industry is underutilized?
I think it's probably a better choice of my words would be misutilized as opposed to underutilized. We haven't examined, for example, capacity in Virginia's inshore fisheries. I don't even know if the data are available. But we've examined capacity in every FMP fishery. I've also have done every tuna fishery of the world now. And we're finding serious, I mean, really serious excess capacity in fisheries. We're looking at a case that you could cut 80% of the fleet. That's not something you want to do. But you could do it and maintain the same level of production that's presently being incurred. You know, so I think by and large, we just need to spend some additional time
but
here.
But, Jim, that was the ITQs. IFQs were supposed to do that.
Well, the ITQs, when they have a moratorium on it, you really can't implement them. So you can't do them. And the fisheries where we've had ITQs, for those of you who don't know, ITQs is a type of quasi-private property right regime. It's an attempt to convey property. It tends to be strongly opposed by people in the fishing industry who are harvesters. A lot of them don't like the idea of saying, here's a property right, you know, to give and take. Fair enough. But in any event, if you start with the wreck fish fishery, it had 91 vessels in it. It's down to 2 vessels, and they're not active. The surf clam fishery, was 54% of the fleet was cut. Those remaining are active. And they're making a lot of good money. You've got IFQs on the West Coast with halibut and sablefish, which have stabilized the fishery, stabilized the revenues, but they've cut the fleet size. Any type of rationalization scheme that's going to be used is going to eventually cut fleet size. I mean, it's the old American thing. You know, you gain an efficiency, something's got to give. You may not like it, but that also doesn't mean you have to have those gains. You can make trade-offs. You know, the economists' world is efficiency is holy, great and wonderful, you know. But in the real world, maybe community viability, maintaining community, maintaining culture and a way of life are just as important. Okay, am I through?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kelly, you got a question?
Importance and impacts are equated. And the rigorous economic theory, it's a matter of semantics. So in rigorous economic theory, there is nothing as economic importance. So primarily versus the first year, the three parts of the economic impacts have an importance not to ruin it. And otherwise, probably the benefit of society. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They do benefit society. But what I'm talking about benefit is, for example, it's July, and you're mowing your lawn, and it's 103 degrees outside. And I walk down the street selling beer. Now, what's that beer worth to you? Probably worth $5. But you only have to pay $1 for it, so you got $4 in benefit. We didn't see the $4 in the market, but you got $4. This is not that. This is the case of you as a fisherman, what did you spend? Well, you bought your fuel, you bought your ice, you bought your bait, you paid your staff, your employees, whatnot, and the other. All right? When you bought your bait and your tackle on your bait and your ice, well, they bought from somebody else, which generated sales. In the process of there were employees who derived income. They spent their money on, you know, housing or rents, utilities, clothes, whatnot, and the other, which generated all additional economic impacts. We can argue that impacts are really nothing but transactions.
I know that. I'm trying to get there. Would y'all, we're going over and we need some time. Would y'all take that to yourselves and work it out? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Jack, do you want to go to the shed or do you want to go with the oyster replacement? Let's go to the oyster replacement and have shed legs.
That's a very good job.
Good afternoon.
Can I ask you a question before we start?
Yes, you may.
Maybe you can answer it in your delivery, but I've been reading over your stuff here, and we used to have 9 acres of good bottom land where we planted corn, and we put something called crotops on it so the crows would need the seed. They made every effort to not destroy that seed before we could grow tall, good corn. Now, we're going to take $1.9 million in seed and let the cattle raise eat them up? I mean, we need some answers.
Well, we're not using $1.9 million for a seed, but...
Well, I mean, whatever you're going to spend out there in seed, you're going to...
are working on the Canos Ray.
Okay.
I mean, that's trying to develop a market.
Let me give you...